Hi, everybody. It's James and Andy here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two-fourths of a group of people who love facts, and we love to find new facts, and we come here every week and tell each other about them. For instance, Andy, did you know that one of the world's oldest cycling road races is getting much harder because people keep stealing the road?
I want to know more already, but I'm instead going to tell you my new fact, which is that some ancient coffins from the 17th century have faces.
The coffins have faces.
It's really creepy.
Not just on the inside.
No.
Wow. If you like the sound of those facts, or indeed facts in general, then come and find us, No Such Thing as a Fish, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan. Happy New Year, everyone. You know, Nish, I had quite the crestfallen moment earlier this year.
Right. Earlier this year. It's the 7th of January as we record. Next week, we're going to do a review of the year podcast.
All I'm saying is at the beginning of the year, and it's the hope that always kills you, and I had this feeling of hope. And I think partly I was hungover, so there's that. And I'd been to this...
You might be the first person to have feelings of hope on a hangover.
I don't get hungover much these days, so it's very thrilling for me. And then I'm, you know, I'm at home, I'm in my little bubble watching Stranger Things and see all those pictures of Zora and Mamdani.
That was in the Stranger Things finale. That is confusing. No wonder people on the internet were baffled.
They were two separate incidents.
Oh, right, fine. I just thought, like, halfway through, they just suddenly cut in some pictures of Mamdani.
Anyway, look, Nish, I had hope, okay? I had it. I looked at my phone and then I saw the story about the kidnapping.
Yeah, sure.
Of a president by Donald Trump. And in that moment, I was like, oh, here it is. Here's my Joker moment.
Never expect things to go well, kids. Listen, we're going to be discussing the latest Trump madness and Starmer's lackluster response to it with Tommy Vietor from our sister podcast, Pod Save America and Pod Save the World.
And on that terrifying note, what other political madness will the new year hold? Political satirist Cody Dalla is here to look ahead at what is going to be a pivotal year in British politics.
Now, listen, this should not have been a shock. A US president taking military action to influence events in South America is nothing new. Venezuela has been a target for Donald Trump for months now as he dialed up political pressure along with airstrikes on so-called drug smuggling boats and a significant increase of naval power in the region.
But somehow he still managed to stun the prime minister as he escalated to the kidnap of a president. Because all we've had from Keir Starmer so far is a pretty weak response to Nicolas Maduro's de facto removal from power.
Now, listen, we're sort of obliged to make these comments, but this is not to celebrate Nicolas Maduro. A 2018 Amnesty International report accused his government of committing some of the worst human rights violations in Venezuela's history, and his authoritarian rule has continued unabated since then. His most recent election victory is widely considered to have been a massive fraud.
The new Venezuelan government, which is essentially the old government with interim president and Maduro ally Delcy Rodriguez in charge, has put armed police and army on the streets to quash any protest.
There's been a huge amount of sort of moralising in the press, but the tone of it is deeply strange. There is this element of the conversation where people are saying, this is not how we do things, okay?
Yeah.
This is not how you institute regime change if you're the president of America. What you do is you embed the CIA in the country for several years and engage in a campaign of disinformation and destabilisation that eventually leads to the leader being assassinated. Or you make wild claims in a dossier that you take to the United Nations. That is how we do things. Not this. There's been an element of people sort of deeming it a bit uncouth in the methodology, not the actual actions itself. I guess the question on everybody's lips is what is going to happen next? Because this isn't obviously just about Venezuela, though what has happened in Venezuela is absolutely appalling. It's about Greenland, which looks to be the next likely Trump takeover target, with a White House statement repeating that acquiring the country a national security priority and that using the military is always an option. It's also about Ukraine, where a peace deal seems closer than it's ever been, and it's about how the UK stands on the world stage at a time where three global superpowers are flexing their muscles, and we absolutely are not one of those three powers.
No, we are not. So who better to try and make sense of the madness than our very own Tommy Vietor from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Due to the time difference between LA and London, we caught up with him remotely earlier.
Tommy, lovely to see you. Welcome back to Pod Save the UK.
Thank you.
What does Trump think he's doing here, just to sort of kick things off?
Look, I think that Trump genuinely believes that he is the emperor of the Western Hemisphere. So he gets to decide who runs Central and South America, as well as maybe Canada. Earlier iterations of that has involved Trump, you know, weighing in on elections in places like Argentina and Honduras and offering Argentina a $40 billion bank bailout out of nowhere to prop up Javier Milei. And now, when it comes to Venezuela, Trump has just decided that we can send in Delta Force troops, our most elite members of the military, and extract Nicolas Maduro and then dictate who will be the next president of Venezuela and just kind of crack on, as you might say. And so, like, he thinks he's the emperor. He thinks that not only does the U.S. get to determine who leads countries, but also we get to say we get dibs on your natural resources. And also we get to say if the Chinese or some other, you know, adversary is trying to lay claim to anything that he wants, he gets to take affirmative steps, including military action, to deter them. So that is, like, I think literally what he believes is his role.
He's been quite upfront about this venture being about oil, and in some bizarre way, a claim to be helping the Americans with affordability. How do you square that circle?
I guess on some level, the honesty about the oil is refreshing. You know, he's not going through the motions and pretending it's about democracy or values. He just doesn't care. He says, I want
the oil. Didn't buy us dinner. No sexed up dossier. No lies about weapons. It's just rude, isn't it?
Yeah, right. We're no yellow cake, right? You know, none of the bullshit from before. He's just like, no, I want the oil, and we're going to get the oil. Now, there's also, like, some sub-issues, right? They claim this is about drug trafficking, but no fentanyl is coming from Venezuela. There's certainly cocaine coming from Venezuela, but most of it's coming from Ecuador and Colombia. So that's, you know, you don't invade Venezuela to deal with cocaine in the U.S. It's also that deals with supply, not demand. I think Trump's trying to argue that in the long term, this is going to flood the U.S. with cheap oil and gas and drop everyone's, you know, prices at the pump and save us all money. In practice, that's going to be very hard to do. It'll take years and $1 billion of investment to actually ramp up production in Venezuela. But yeah, I mean, that is their kind of, like, stated benefit for the U.S. so far.
Tommy, over here, obviously, everyone's immediate pivot has been concern over what this might mean for Greenland, because Greenland has become part of the world that Trump believes he has dominion over, Central America, Southern America, and then stretching up to Canada and to Greenland. He's been fairly clear about his intentions on this. How concerned should, particularly at the moment, the Danish government be?
I think we should take him seriously when he says things like, I want Greenland, over and over and over again. In the beginning, this conversation felt like a bit of trolling. You know, like, there's a lot of people around Trump who like to get a rise out of lefty liberals like us, right, and make us mad on Twitter. And you saw that a bit over the weekend. You know, Stephen Miller, the deputy chief of staff's wife, Katie Miller, who is currently the host of the most boring podcast ever made. She tweeted, like, Greenland with an American flag on it, right? And I think, you know, that gotten a lot of attention. But the Europeans are taking this very seriously. Like, I'm looking at a joint statement on Greenland from the president of France, chancellor of Germany, prime minister of Italy. Like, the list goes on and on. So I do think there's a very real chance Trump decides, I want Greenland, and tries to take it somehow and implodes NATO in the process.
As someone who has a guilty pleasure of watching Amazon Prime action movies, and I feel like Trump's watching the same ones and has decided that's how he's going to run the world, I nonetheless find myself trying to get inside of his head. Okay, so if it's about military bases, well, I'm pretty sure the Danish have said you can open military bases. If it's about mining and resources, well, I'm pretty sure the Danes have said, okay, we can have a conversation about that. Could it be that Donald Trump just wants to expand American territory?
I think it's more like that. Yeah, I think this is, like, legacy items for him. He wants Greenland. He thinks claiming territory is, you know, your way to be in the history books. I mean, I do think there are actual, like, arguments being made to him about the need for Arctic access, as all the gas and oil companies that he's propping up burn fossil fuels and slowly melt away all the ice caps so that it's easier to mine for more oil and gas. I'm sure there is a security argument being made about the Russians and the Chinese sending, you know, their fleets up there. But yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just, like, ambition. You know, he wants big splashy headlines. He wants to take territory. He wants to be in the history books.
But that's it for NATO, right? If he invades Greenland, that's the end of that organization.
What one would imagine. I mean, so we invade Greenland. NATO invokes Article 5 against the United States. So then we are committed to attacking ourselves. So I guess the U.S. just withdraws from NATO. I mean, like, all we can do is laugh. It's so comically insane. But yeah, like, if I was in Greenland, I'd be worried. If I were, in Panama, I'd be worried about the Panama Canal. I mean, I think that, like, we are still in the midst of this major diplomatic and economic rupture with Canada, our very, very friendly neighbors to the north, because Trump kept threatening to annex them and calling them the 51st state and slapping tariffs on them, despite the fact that his administration had negotiated a trade deal with these guys. So, like, we are through the looking glass, people. This is some crazy shit.
It is strange because Starmer's got a bit of a reputation as being a Trump whisperer. I don't really know how that works. I mean, I haven't whispered a horse, but I think if you just do everything the horse says, you're not a horse whisperer. I think that's how that works. And there's been a lot of conversation here today about Starmer's response and whether he should have been tougher on Trump. But he's repeatedly ducked giving a straight answer about whether Trump broke international law with this initiative. He said, well, it's not up to us to decide. He's been a bit more forceful on Greenland, though.
The future of Greenland is for Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark, and for Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark alone.
I guess my question to you is, would it have made any difference if Keir Starmer, supposed Trump whisperer, did come out and say, well, actually, look, I'm a former human rights lawyer. I believe in the rule of law. No, this was not okay. And I'm happy to say that.
I think he should say that. I think it matters. I think there's a collective action problem, which is, you know, none of these countries want to be kind of in the eye of Sauron and Trump's next target, because, you know, you saw Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, kind of lightly criticizing Trump over Gaza several months ago. And now Trump is threatening to bomb or invade Colombia as well. Now, I do think, like, we are long past the time where, like, anyone can pretend to be the Trump whisperer, where we need, like, Emmanuel Macron taking another trip to the U.S. to try to, like, butter Trump up and get some concession for Ukraine. Like, that strategy has failed. I think that Trump respects strength. None of these guys look particularly strong right now. And that's what I saw some clip going around last night. It was a Sky News reporter pleading with a Labour MP whose name is escaping me.
Just, yes.
He's like, can you please just say that it's not okay to invade Greenland? And this man just wouldn't. I was like, that looks so pathetic. It looks so feckless.
Former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn went on LBC and actually pointed out, you know, this kind of issue over the international law. We can actually hear that clip right now.
What is preventing Sir Keir Starmer from saying something serious and informative about the breach of international law? After all, he is, as he often tells us, a human rights lawyer.
So much of Starmer's kind of political brand is built around this idea of him as the former lawyer and him as the person who respects the rule of law, having succeeded a Conservative government that did not respect the rule of law. How are you briefing former human rights lawyer, whose kind of only thing is he's a judicious rule follower, on how to deal with this particular situation?
Yeah, look, just with the stipulation that I'm doing this from the cheap seats, which is podcasting. I mean, like, I think you're making the core point, which is this is not just like a random issue. It's like, what do you think about Nagorno-Karabakh? You know, this is like, this is core to your identity. This is who you are, Keir Starmer. This is what you did. This is why you are here. This is why anybody knows about you. If you're willing to fold in such a fundamental way on this issue and not speak up about what is an obvious breach of international law, which is obviously just the wrong thing to do, given the very recent history with Iraq and Libya, which was my boss, by the way, Barack Obama, right? Like, Libya, when Gaddafi went down, it looked good. And there was a lot of triumphalism in Washington. And decades later, it is still a slow rolling disaster across North Africa and parts of the Middle East. And so I think, you know, Starmer needs to speak up, but he also needs to coordinate with other European leaders like Friedrich Merz and others and say, look, we have to speak with one voice here. We got to toughen up a bit, because bullies can spot and smell weakness. And I just think Trump is going to keep gobbling up and gobbling up what he wants unless he gets some pushback. And, you know, you look at Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico. She has been tougher on Trump, and he seems like he respects her for that. And I do think maybe there's a lesson there.
I also always wondered why Starmer didn't do it, even just for domestic pursuits. You know, on our podcast, we've discussed how, particularly J.D. Vance, he likes to bash London because domestically that looks good. And part of me is like, well, Donald Trump is enormously unpopular in the UK. Keir Starmer also enormously unpopular in the UK. Would that not work even just on a domestic level?
This is kind of the thing that confuses me. If I were Prime Minister Starmer's pollster, I would say, sir, look at this chart. it can't get much worse. You know, like, we're down to like, you know, relatives and close friends here that approve of you. So throw a punch, right? Like, what about some good old fashioned nationalism and nativism? A good old fashioned, you know, fuck you, you know, Hugh Grant style to the asshole American president. Like, wouldn't that be good politics? Wouldn't that play well? Or telling Nigel Farage, like, are you on the side of the British people or are you on Donald Trump's side? This seems like bad politics and bad policy to me.
There's been a lot of phrases used like the Don Rowe doctrine, and this is, we're seeing like an expression of Trump's kind of foreign policy vision. And I've always thought ascribing any sort of doctrine to Trump, it is like diagnosing a dog with an anxiety disorder. It's like, I'm not completely sure that this man is like capable of mounting a doctrine. But there does seem to be this idea emerging from various foreign policy analysts that Trump sees the world as being ruled by three global powers, and that the US has dominion over this kind of Atlantic side, Russia has dominion over Europe, and China has dominion over the Pacific. And as long as the three superpowers don't interfere in each other's sphere of influence, then it's all gravy, right? Is that just us trying to ascribe some kind of order onto what's happened? And this is just Trump, you know, following whatever his latest whim is. You know, for him, it's the oil industry. Or actually, do you think this is a real thing? This is the way he sees the world. And this is the vision and foreign policy thing that he's trying to execute here.
Yeah, I mean, look, I tend to agree with you that this is not, you know, Winston Churchill here. He's not a big thinker with big ideas and, you know, he's a student of history. That said, the White House released something called the National Security Strategy late last year. It was a lot of it. The Europe section was kind of copied and pasted from J.D. Vance's speech in Germany. I think it was in Munich several months back, where he was said the real issue in Europe was, you know, censorship of, you know, tech companies or whatever. But then there was a very like kind of meaty section about the Western Hemisphere that outlined this, you know, Trump addendum to the Monroe Doctrine, which basically says like the Western Hemisphere is ours. And I think the question I have is whether that is a tacit recognition that the world is actually divided up into three spheres of influence. Like, it seems like he's willing to cede Ukraine, or at least a big chunk of it, to the Russians. We'll see if that includes Baltic states or other NATO countries. I think it's an open question about whether Trump is willing to cede Asia to the Chinese. That might include Taiwan, but also there are disputed island chains between the Chinese and the Japanese, for example. And if there's a conflict there, it's like, does the United States defend our treaty ally? Or are we just saying, you know what, dominant power, Chinese, our hands are off. I mean, the current setup of U.S. hegemony is that we want to be dominant in every sphere. It does seem like a weaker vision of U.S. power if we are ceding Asia to the Chinese. But we'll see, I guess.
Hypothetically, Europe, quite big, if you put all the states together. Now, I know you're not going to get everyone, you're not going to get an Orban to see your side, but do you think we could collectively stand up to Donald Trump and this sphere of influence, ideology or approach that he's taking?
I mean, I think there's a lot of economic power there, right? If you think of the EU as a bloc, and even if Orban's gone, it's like, okay, best of luck, pal. Clearly, if Donald Trump decides to completely withdraw from NATO, I mean, that just, you know, guts the organization in terms of its capabilities as a fighting force or a military. But I do think Trump respects strength. Look at the tariffs fight, for example, right? He announced Liberation Day on the Chinese, slapped a big tariff on them. The Chinese responded with a really, really hard series of punches, and he basically backed down. He pretends now that we have a trade agreement with the Chinese, where they are going to buy a bunch of soybeans and we're going to give them the most advanced AI chips that one can buy all of a sudden for no reason. But in reality, there really is no deal. He kind of lost that fight and he just didn't want the smoke that would come to the U.S. economy. I think the Chinese are a bigger economic player, but there's a version of that that you could imagine with the EU where there's a hard punch back that gets him to, you know, buckle a little bit. Now, I think the problem comes like, what happens if right-wing parties win in elections in 2026 in the UK, and then, you know, the National Rally and, you know, Marine Le Pen or Jordan Bardella, her little number two, wins in France, and then the AfD could start winning a bunch of elections in Germany. Then you have like a scary far-right EU to contend with, and I don't know how that goes, but I do think like probably now is the moment to toughen up a little bit and start, you know, trying to right-size these relationships.
Tommy, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK. I'd love to say it's lovely to see you.
Wonderful.
But it's on the worst circumstances.
Now, if you want to hear more from Tommy, head to Pod Save the World, where he unpacks the latest with co-host Ben Rhodes. New episodes drop on Wednesday. Make sure you subscribe so you never miss a beat.
After the break, what else might be in store for us in 2026? We'll be freaking out over the undoubtedly terrifying possibilities with political satirist Cody Darla. This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe.
When it comes to sending money abroad, many providers claim to offer free fees and competitive rates. But don't be fooled. This can be code for inflated exchange rates.
With the Wise account, you can send, spend and receive money in over 40 currencies without ever having to worry about hidden fees.
If you're sending pounds across the pond, well, most transfers arrive in 20 seconds or less.
The Wise travel card gives you the mid-market rate on every purchase and there are no costly markups on your bill.
With 24/7 access to live support, your international transactions with Wise are quick, transparent and safe. Plus, Wise runs over 7 million daily checks to catch and prevent fraud.
15 million people already trust Wise to manage their money internationally. Be smart, get Wise. We've got international family.
Yes.
We travel a lot for work. Sometimes it's very difficult and complicated to transfer money. Using Wise takes all of the stress out of that.
Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, everybody. It's James and Andy here from your next favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two-fourths of a group of people who love facts and we love to find new facts and we come here every week and tell each other about them. For instance, Andy, did you know that one of the world's oldest cycling road races is getting much harder because people keep stealing the road?
I want to know more already, but I'm instead going to tell you my new fact, which is that some ancient coffins from the 17th century have faces.
The coffins have faces.
It's really creepy.
Not just on the inside.
No.
Wow. If you like the sound of those facts, or indeed facts in general, then come and find us, No Such Thing as a Fish, wherever you get your podcasts.
Is set to be a pivotal year in British politics. The next 12 months are make or break for the government. Will Keir Starmer stage a fight back or will reform come out on top?
We had big plans to dust off Coco's giant crystal ball and make some predictions for what political madness lies ahead. But then 3 days in, Donald Trump blindsided us. So with Venezuela and Greenland firmly added to the ever-growing list of things about which we should be shitting our pants, what will the big defining political issues be in the year ahead? Here to give us a helping hand is Cody Darla, who, I hate to say this, is yet another political comedian and podcaster. Cody, welcome to Pod Save the UK.
Thank you so
I've
much.
Always said we need more unfounded opinion on this show.
I'm so glad you brought this up because I have been living in your shadow for the last 5 years. So
I'm like, always...
Is Cody Nish Kumar? No, he's not. My career has just been struggling this year. I've been waiting for a horrible accident to get rid of you. But here we are in the same room.
Now's your time to step out of the Kumar shadow.
Yeah, this is my job interview for your position.
So, Cody, you've written for BBC Radio 4's most popular comedy shows, including Dead Ringers, Please Use Other Door and Newsjack, and of course you host your own podcast, The Truth In My Opinion. That's brackets, in my opinion. But you're probably most famous for your online videos. I've seen them. I'm a follower. Like this excellent impersonation of the British establishment reacting to Trump's attack on Venezuela.
Well, first of all, big congratulations to all of us. I think we've been dealing with this Trump-Venezuela situation very well.
Yeah, nothing screams we're not panicking like the noise Darren Jones made on Sunday.
It's for the Americans to set out the legal basis.
I always go, when I feel in control. Me too.
So, this is a question I often have about comedians, because I work very closely with Nish.
Yes.
And I find comedians a specific person. Quite a specific people, aren't they? And I often wonder, if you're doing politics as comedy, does it make it harder to do your job when the world has gone to shit, or easier? What is the relationship there? Do you feel more galvanised to do this work because you need people to engage with politics? Genuinely, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and increasingly, and I hope you're ready for Coco's thought of the year, maybe.
Oh, no.
And the first...
5 days in.
Oh, no. 5 days in. Right.
I'm immediately
I had
worried.
This little moment where I was like lying in my bed thinking about Donald Trump and Greenland and Keir Starmer, and I had this moment where I was like, no one is going to save us. No leader, no institution is going to save us. All we have is each other. And we have to learn to connect with each other. And how do we do that?
comedy, laughter, empathy. So anyway, hate to break it to you, you're saving the world.
Yeah, don't worry, guys. Don't worry. People of Greenland, don't worry.
We're on the case.
The American troops are on the ground. Don't worry. We will be satirizing the hell out of your imminent occupation. Everybody in Greenland, relax.
Nish and Cody are here.
Yeah, the one-liners are taken care of.
Yeah, you've got to start to worry when we start wearing hard hats in our videos.
But Trump is particularly like an unusual character, right?
Yeah, having a clown in the White House does make it easier to make people laugh because people love, like, it sort of writes itself in a way.
Yeah.
But it's getting to the point where we're etching closer and closer to destruction. How do you, like, make fun of the end of the world?
Yeah.
And but equally, how do you make fun of them in terms of, like, challenging their power or challenging their views?
Yeah.
Because now, for example, just this week, you make fun of what Donald Trump's doing. Like, lots of people will laugh and find it funny, but there'll be lots of people being like, I can't laugh at this.
Yeah.
And then equally, they'll be like, you know, you'll make fun of reform and you'll go through your comments and you'll find the people who already agree with you being like, oh, that's great. And then the people who don't agree with you being like, I either don't believe you or I don't find this funny and I'm now going to vote for them even more. But there's this sort of zone where you're like, satire is kind of blunted. Still feel like it's sort of blunted.
There's so much to unpack there. I mean, also just in terms of, like, humour being human, and we live in an age of algorithms, but let's try and get into some politics and the year ahead. So it's been a really tough start for the government, with YouGov polling for Sky and The Times putting Labour in third place behind the Tories and Reform. This is a huge deal. It's the first time they've dropped behind the Tories since the general election.
And not only this, according to a Stats for Lefties analysis of YouGov polling, Keir Starmer is less popular than Venezuelan President Maduro. The PM has come out fighting in a long New Year's interview with the BBC's Laura Koonsberg. Let's take a look.
Well, I will be sitting in this seat by 2027, and if this long-form interview works, we can try it again in January of next year as well.
Cody, are you convinced?
That was a zinger.
Look convinced by the words that were coming out of his own mouth.
He never does. He never does. I know all of the opinions are that he's going to be ousted. I'm going to put my neck on the line and say I think he's going to still be around.
Oh, I love it when people put their neck on the line.
That's
good. Yeah, that was a big swing. Do you think he's going to still be around?
So I think he's still going to be around because there aren't any other people who look more attractive than Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
Like the kind of front runner, and I think this says a lot about Labour, is Wes Streeting.
Yes.
Who looks like the sort of illegitimate child of Lumiere from Beauty and the Beast. He just looks like a candle. And then there's Angela Rayner, who I just don't think also will command the sort of respect of the general public. And then there's Andy Burnham, who's not an MP. So I think logistically, it's going to be quite hard for someone to unseat him. And then there's the other side of things, which is because Labour have such an absence of any policies, their strongest suit is literally looking stable, looking sane. Like, they are mediocre and stable. If they get rid of their leader, then they don't look stable and they're mediocre and that's disastrous. I just think that's going to be their strategy. That's the only strategy that could possibly work for Labour.
Elsewhere in the Koonsberg interview, when he was asked about the real changes the public should feel in the coming year, Starmer repeatedly pointed to bearing down on child poverty. And in his first cabinet meeting, he reiterated that his focus remains on tackling the cost of living. Potentially, he's been taking a leaf out of Mamdani's playbook in focusing on affordability.
Right. So Starmer's chief advisor, Morgan McSweeney, also called this year the year of proof. It's the year when they hope public services would begin to improve, bills start to fall. So, you know, is this the year, do you think, when we start to feel an improvement in those living standards? And do you think it will be enough to cut through to voters who are already disillusioned?
Yeah, we should substantiate this, I should say, by saying that there is some good news coming for people living in this country. Mm-hmm. So rail fares in England will be frozen for the first time in 30 years until March 2027. April is going to see a 4.8% rise in the state pension, a 4.1% rise in the minimum wage, and the end of the two-child limit on welfare, and a 3.8% rise in benefits. And September is going to bring the expansion of free school meals to all families on universal credit. That's all happening at the same time, though, as food prices seemingly refusing to fall, with the British Retail Consortium cautioning that they will remain sticky in 2026 after rising 3.3% in December. Fresh food costs are rising at 3.8%, or almost twice
the Bank of England's inflation target.
It's weird when you hear numbers like that. One, the sort of percentages, I understand they're improvements, but what does it really mean?
Yeah.
The rail fares one really stuck out to me when it's like, oh, they will be frozen where they are. So, okay, they will remain an arm and a leg.
Yeah, I think
this is... It will cost you your first child to go to Bristol.
Yeah, that is slightly the problem, is that a freeze is bad. Because the rail fares had already escalated out of control.
Yeah, that is like the problem of the government, isn't it? When they're like, okay, we'll do something. And everyone's like, yeah, but it's still shit, isn't it?
Yeah,
you're like,
right.
Yeah, it is still shit, but it could have been shitter. But saying things are shit, but they could have been shitter is like, it doesn't fly anymore.
And also, it is going to become shit. Mm. More shit. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, just rattling some shit incoming. Higher water bills in April, higher council tax in April. Unemployment, by the way, everyone's talking about that. They're looking at unemployment being as high as it was during COVID. You know, there's stagnant real wages. So even if they're saying we're holding it, not really. Not really when you dig into it.
What would you like to see the government be doing, Cody, in the face of all of these challenges?
Oh, God. I think it's an impossible position they've gotten themselves in, basically, where I think we're at a political moment where people at large are becoming awakened to a more radical alternative.
Mm.
Lots of people are now, in the last year, talking, thanks to like sort of Zach Polanski and the Greens, talking about taxing the rich. That is, you know, previously quite a radical thought. More people are like, oh, we need to get rid of the immigrants. And it's those sorts of extremes that are kind of rising to the fore. And so Labour are finding themselves in a position where they're ultimately trying to defend a status quo, which everybody hates.
Yeah.
So they have to be more radical. They have to nationalise our water. They have to nationalise our energy. They've got the big green energy programme, which is like going to cost loads, right? But it is a kind of step in the right direction because it's nationalised. And it's like the good thing about that is that it's using like taxpayers' money, our money, to benefit the population. And it's like they're constantly banging on about that. That sentiment needs to be applied to everything. Keir Starmer's thing is saying, you know, we're going to be making a difference to people's lives. We're going to be, you know, alleviating poverty, whatever. You have more money in your pocket. I think we're weirdly in a space where we want to see the people with loads of money be punished. Like, we want to see the companies, like, not giving millions of pounds to their shareholders. We want to see the billionaires not flying around in private jets. And that's the kind of dichotomy I feel like.
I did a show yesterday, it will remain nameless, that we had some callers from the general public. Some of those callers I would describe politically quite right-wing. I would say maybe very right-wing. And we were talking...
Quite right.
Yeah, mainly just shouting abuse at me, which is, I guess, my job as a left-wing
person. People on a call-in show. Right-wing. I'll never hear of it.
Anyway, there was this phrase that kept coming up from various callers about Donald Trump and what he's done in Venezuela, where they're like, well, at least he's doing something.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not right, but at least he's doing something. We're so critical. And obviously, I'm like, what do you mean he's doing something? He's doing something terrible. However, that feeling of doing something, there's something in that, isn't there? And I think that feeling that Keir Starmer's not doing something, it's just a tinker, that it's just
I will
a
say,
edit.
I think Trump may have found the only worst alternative to doing nothing.
Listen, for clarity, this is in no way a condonement of Donald Trump, but I found it fascinating that something that was so clearly wrong on every level to me was getting favour from people purely because it was noteworthy.
I can't believe that we're not talking about nationalisation of the water companies, because the water companies' actions in the last decade have been absolutely criminal. If you think about how much money has been extracted out of the network and into shareholders' pockets, that isn't something that the government should be allowing. I also think I'm not convinced that Labour can deliver meaningful change under the current fiscal rules that they have boxed themselves into. And this idea of no increases on taxes on working people is something that I think people would go along with if it ever happened. But in reality, the freezing of the tax thresholds is a real terms tax increase for working people. I genuinely think people would accept that if they believed that that burden was being spread, not even just evenly across society, but the burden was being spread more heavily on people who could bear it a bit more. If those tax thresholds being frozen came alongside changes to the capital gains tax system, an attempt to equalise the tax on wealth and the tax on work, which has become imbalanced in our economics framework, I think that people would be more willing to swallow that stuff. But in reality, we are seeing just more taxes on middle class, lower middle class and working class people in this country. And there isn't rebalancing. And part of it is because of these fiscal rules that they've boxed themselves into. So look, the big test for Labour is going to be the May elections, with Scottish and Welsh parliaments up for grabs, as well as 32 London boroughs and 100 other English councils. Scottish Labour's polling has plummeted since the election, and they fear third place behind the SNP and Reform. Meanwhile, in Wales, polling predicts that Welsh Labour could be a junior partner in a coalition with the left-wing nationalist Plaid Cymru. And in London, the Greens threaten Labour from the left.
It's been a big year for Reform UK, who began to top the polls, but YouGov's December polling showed a drop in its vote share to 26%. That would be the lowest since April. So, Cody, what do you think? Have we reached peak Farage? They are top of the polls, but it's a weird system, isn't it? Because everyone's hated, so top of the polls is still not hugely popular. Anyway.
Yeah, I think there probably is a finite number of lunatics in the country. And I think there's actually...
You hope.
We hope. But I think there's actually this kind of the forgotten grouping in society who often decide elections, which are like this sort of slightly pissed 50-year-olds, you know? And I think there is... I would like to think, anyway, that there is a limit to like what that quite important middle grouping would vote for. Yeah. And I think, you know, the stuff about Nigel Farage, you know, being racist and anti-Semitic at school. I mean, he's like turned around and said, oh, that's just bolstering my base. Well, you don't have to worry about his base. We know his base will vote for him no matter what. But I think those things do chip away at quite an important section of the electorate who aren't maybe so forthcoming about their views, or they're not just dyed-in-the-wool reform heads, but they would consider voting for them. I think those things make a difference.
And you're talking about Facebook boomers.
Maybe MySpace Gen Xers?
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Exactly. That's a good word. And I think there's an elastic group. I think reform will get to a level. I don't think they'll ever get enough to win a majority.
Beyond deport them, beyond get them the fuck out of my country, Farage actually really lacks a cohesive policy platform. You know, the speeches that we've seen in the last kind of 6 months have been a kind of odd combination of calling for the abolition of the two-child benefit cap and weirdly stewed in there a bit of sort of Christian nationalism. It's an odd gumbo he's brewing. And the other issue I think that they have is that Reform does run some bits of this country. Reform runs some councils in this country, and it's not going well for them.
No.
Kent County Council was won on a mandate to slash government spending, but according to the BBC, it's currently overspending by 3%, with adult social care running 7% above its overall budget. There are various stories of Reform-run councils already in chaos, and I do wonder if that is going to be something that actually has cut through. And people do genuinely worry. I mean, there's little to no evidence that Doge offered any meaningful savings in what Elon Musk did in the White House. And there is a huge amount of evidence that it's actually damaged America's standing around the world. And if its agenda is allowed to be carried out over the term of the next 4 years, it will lead to people dying. The specific cuts to USAID are actually going to kill people, right? And so I just wonder if some of this Farage rhetoric, like the Trump rhetoric, on contact with reality is just evaporating. I'm interested to know how much meaningful cut through that actually has.
Clearly, the reform-led councils, this approach is not going to work.
Yeah.
There was a report from The Guardian saying that they want to raise tax by the maximum allowed. This is going to be a sore point for them when they're facing the upcoming elections in spring. So what are they going to do about it? They'll probably release some horribly xenophobic, racist policy that will get us all distracted about that. Or they'll do something that will make the average person of colour or migrant feel less safe on the street to distract from the conversation about council spending. That is a fear of mine.
Or they'll invade Colombia.
Yeah.
The local councils. But I think there's... there's a weird loop when it comes to reform. Because what I'm going to say now is maybe slightly contradicts what I said before, but like the reason reform do quite well, and this is what the Labour government are resting on, is they're like the cost of living. So like people feel worse off, they vote for reform. But the problem is like a lot of politics is delivered at a local level. So you need to have like quite competent people in your local council to actually make your immediate life feel better. You know, it's like to fill in potholes, you need someone who knows where the potholes are. So the problem is people vote for Reform UK because they're like, my life's shit. And then all the councillors that come in are just like people like, do you know what we need? You know what will fix this? Getting rid of the LGBTQ flag outside the building. So they get rid of that. Then life gets worse because they're incompetent. And then their voter base is like, This fucking Labour government, man. Yeah, this Labour government is so... We need to get more reform in. So it's like this doom loop of shit where they just elect incompetent people who actually don't ever take the blame for things. So I think, in a way, I would hope that we're in the slightly logical position where them doing poorly in local government will have an impact. But equally, the flip side, I can also see people being like, well, yeah, it's life's still shit, so we need more reform.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
Farage struggles when he is put under any kind of meaningful scrutiny. And I think it's very incumbent on the British media, and obviously I include us in that, to keep talking about the chaos that's happening under reform-led councils, because that is a kind of dry run of what it would look like if they're allowed to run the country. And I do think Farage has been sort of uniquely celebrated by too many sections of the British press in the last 25 years. Now, after the break, we're going to look at some other issues that are coming for us in the year ahead, including, obviously, migration, AI and the climate. And we hear an update on the remaining Palestine Action hunger strikers.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Babbel.
Listen, the idea of learning a new language feels incredibly overwhelming. And if that's you that's feeling that, you're not alone. Studies show that 70 to 90% of people trying to learn a new language give up. Fortunately, Babbel is built so that it's really easy to get started. They understand that people learn differently. So you can dive into a podcast when you don't quite feel like a quick lesson. You can speak out loud to get that practice in. You can explore courses based on specific topics and even create your own customized review list, all within the app.
Learning a language with Babbel is all about small steps, big wins, and progress that you can actually track and feel. Their bite-sized lessons fit easily into your daily routine and are also easy to remember. Just 10 minutes a day is enough to start seeing real results.
Babbel lets you practice real-life conversations step by step without the stress. You'll build the confidence to speak up when it matters, from ordering a coffee to chatting with new friends abroad.
And Babbel is more than just lessons. They even offer a large collection of podcasts where Babbel experts reveal language secrets and offer an inside look at local cultures.
I'm going to use Babbel to restart my French speaking. I did an A-level in French and have, in the intervening 22 years, seemingly forgotten all of it.
I have to say, you speaking French does not fit with your personality.
Is that true?
Well, I mean, actually, to be fair, you're a very worldly person. You're a very cultured person. Yeah. And that would certainly unlock... I mean, learning a language really unlocks so much. I guess I just mean you don't strike me as the sort of shrug guy. You're more the scream guy?
Yes. I don't have a naturally Gallic energy. But would it help you to know that in my French A-level oral exam, my chosen topic was Jean-Luc Godard and the Nouvelle Vague?
Sure. Okay. That makes
so just
sense.
So that you know, I've always been unbearably pretentious. And so there are elements that are consistent within my character. Babbel has over 25 million subscriptions sold worldwide. And with 14 languages to choose from, every course comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee.
Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/PSUK.
Get 60% off at babbel.com/PSUK, spelled BABBEL.com/PSUK.
Rules and restrictions may apply.
The What A Day podcast you know and love is shaking things up. You already know that 5 days a week, I, Jane Costin, bring you the need-to-know news and expert analysis on the big stories shaping today and tomorrow. Stories like how social media warps our perception of the world and the strange reality of who is signing up to work for ICE. All in less time than it takes to roast a chicken. And now, What A Day episodes will be hitting your YouTube and podcast feeds in the afternoons. You'll get the breaking news even faster. Check out What A Day, now dropping in the PM on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
So look, migration was once again the dominant issue in British politics in 2025. And I think we can safely predict it will continue to be the dominant conversation in British politics in 2026. Labour promised some tough immigration reforms in November. It's actually got to deliver them. We kicked off January with new powers to seize phones from migrants coming into force, which I think we can all agree fills us with a deep sense of national pride. There's nothing that makes me feel more proud to be British than taking mobile phones from vulnerable people. Cody, is this going to move the dial for the Labour Party, this kind of hard tack to the right?
No, No, absolutely not.
It might move the dial, just not in a way that...
Exactly. Yeah. It will move the dial
moving
away
downwards
from
is still a moving dial.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think when it comes to the Labour Party and migration, there is nothing they can do. I don't know if you caught this back in October. There was a BBC article about Buxton in Derbyshire, and there was a local government plan to expand the River Wye in the area. And the first comment on their Facebook post about this was to make more room for the dinghies.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
This is Buxton is 250 miles away from Dover. There are, according to the latest government figures, zero asylum seekers in Buxton. So this is a part of the country that has no interaction whatsoever with asylum seekers, yet they are furious about it. And actually, I should say, to be fair to the people of Buxton, they were extremely welcoming to some asylum seekers, but they were Ukrainian. Right. So they have housed 150 Ukrainians, which they welcome with open arms. I wonder what feature they enjoy about them.
Yeah.
So I think when it comes to migration and actual policy, I think it's quite a pessimistic view, but we are so far beyond policy when it comes to this topic. People hate migration even when they don't know any migrants. So it's incredibly difficult for the Labour government to turn the dial on it by bringing in policies, I think.
That story has really bummed me out.
It's mental, isn't it? I heard about it because my friend's mum lived in Buxton. She was like, we fucking got out of there. And she was like, we've moved to Ramsgate. I was like, not much of an improvement, but at least I think closer to the boats, those pesky boats.
Yeah.
One thing to watch is going to be the future of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is going to reach a crunch point in mid-May when member states will meet to agree on a political declaration on how the ECHR is applied. Now, Britain wants to reshape the application of Article 3 on inhumane or degrading treatment so it blocks fewer deportations. I think this is going to be a very, very sticky thing for Starmer. I think this is going to be very, very difficult for him to move on with the ECHR. His whole thing is, I respect institutions. He doesn't offer much else. And so his whole thing is, I respect institutions and I respect international law. But changing international law in order to improve your ability to deport people. I mean, I think that is going to be a hard sell to Labour's base. And also, crucially, I actually, and this is a very controversial view, don't believe this is going to get people's energy bills down. I don't believe that deporting more people is actually going to do anything meaningful for people's energy bills. The conversation around the ECHR, I think, is going to get very depressing very quickly.
Yeah. And we should also mention that in this unmitigated chaos, let's call it, which has unfolded over the last year, you might have missed the stories about climate doom.
Yeah, it's really worrying stuff. Across Europe, there have been horror stories. The wildfires last year in Spain and Portugal were reportedly 40 times more likely because of the climate crisis. Who knows what extreme temperatures and weather 2026 will bring.
But we do want to give credit where it's due. The UK has made some positive steps. Since 1990, greenhouse gas emissions have more than halved in Britain, and the government did just set an ambitious target to reduce emissions by at least 81% by 2035. But the picture around the world is less rosy.
That's right. Last October, the UN Secretary General said it was now inevitable that humanity would overshoot the 1.5 degree target with devastating consequences. Cody, is the plan just give up and watch the world burn, flood and freeze at the same time?
Yeah, it seems so, doesn't it? That's my plan anyway.
I mean, while Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil and Insulate Britain were doing much more kind of public-facing stunts and large-scale protests, it felt like it had kept the climate conversation at the forefront of the news agenda. Then everybody said, this is annoying. You're annoying people.
Yeah.
So they've kind of scaled back a lot of their operations in terms of direct action. And now we never talk about the climate and all we talk about is immigrants and immigration.
It's so true.
I mean, it does feel like we need a bit of old-school XR Just Stop Oil tactics to force the conversation back to the top of the political agenda.
Well, I mean, nothing encapsulates this more than the Green Party, right? The Green Party only talk about the cost of living crisis. Their argument, of course, is that you tackle the climate crisis by you know, having renewables, which brings people's bills down. And I think it speaks to the perilous political position we're in, which is you can't talk about the environment anymore because people are like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I can't feed my kids.
Yeah.
I think that's what the Greens are doing very well in that sense. But it means immediately we're not talking about that kind of old schools. Everything's burning. We're all going to die. Yeah. There's going to be floods and everything. We're instead talking about energy energy security, renewables, which is part of the same discussion as the environment, but it feels, I guess, less pressing and immediate.
That's quite maddening. I mean, even this conversation that we've been having about Maduro and Trump, I mean, that is about oil.
Yeah.
Oil is a fossil fuel. Imagine if we just all moved off of that. Maybe there could even be less war. But as soon as you mention that, there is a national switch off. It must be really frustrating.
I saw a really good thing where, whether it was a meme or a tweet, I forget, but someone was like, no one would invade another country for renewables.
Yeah, yeah. No one's invading. No one's invading Venezuela to get this
get their wind farms.
Panels. Yeah. So, a report from the Climate Change Committee says the UK can hit its upcoming emissions reductions targets and remain on target for net zero, but only with further policy action. If sanity were to prevail, this would be the main thing that we talk about and not immigration, for fuck's sake. But let's move on before my head explodes.
So finally, there's one thing we can all bet on, which is that the AI insanity will continue into 2026. So last week, a trend took off on X as users began asking Grok, the platform's AI chatbot, to generate sexualized images of people on the platform. Users began tagging the AI, asking it to do things like remove her clothes or put him in a jockstrap. The chatbot happily complied. Thousands of images of partially naked people were created, all without the victim's knowledge or consent.
Yes, and look, this story somehow is even grislier than that. There are reports that Grok even created sexualized images of minors depicted wearing minimal clothing. In a supposedly AI-created apology, Grok itself admitted that it had generated and shared an AI image of two young girls. The estimated ages are between 12 and 16 in sexualized attire.
So despite the growing outcry and the platform's commitment to suspend users who generate these images, so far, nothing has changed. It appears that Grok can still be used to generate these kinds of images.
I mean, nothing about this is surprising particularly, right, Cody?
It's not surprising, no. Why are people in their thousands prompting this AI bot to even do that? I mean, it really is a story that I think highlights perfectly the really poisonous element of the internet and social media.
Yeah.
And you know, but Grok has been in trouble and Elon Musk has been in trouble for AI generating, like, I think when he launched it, it got in trouble for AI generating celebrities. Taylor Swift, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, he's just like an edgelord. That's all he is. And it's like, he's so rich and powerful that I think he's enjoying this. There's no way he's going to change Grok. Like, because I think all of the other AI machines now, whatever you call them, learning models, you can't, if you put those things in, if you get them to undress people, they won't do it. But Grok is the only one that's still doing it, right? Because he's not interested in changing it.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that this gets brought up all the time because Elon Musk is consistently on Twitter talking about how we need to protect women and girls from the threats of black and brown people and transgender people. Meanwhile, his AI has become a kind of facilitation engine for sex crimes, you know? And it's really important that this kind of stuff keeps getting brought up. Ofcom has said it would undertake a swift assessment to determine whether there are potential compliance issues that warrant investigation. I'd say there's some pretty big compliance issues. Based on what Grok itself has acknowledged has happened, I think you can knock that out before lunch, lads.
Yeah, I think we could solve that now.
Yeah,
couldn't we?
I don't think that'd take very long. I mean, how is AI use going to change in 2026? I mean, we were told that this technology was supposed to be this kind of thing that would unlock various mysteries of science and be of use to, and be of use to doctors, which it may well be. But I don't see how creating paedophilic art is part of that process.
If there's a slightly optimistic element to this story, I think it will be that, you know, there's all this talk when it comes to AI about the superintelligence and replacing us. It demonstrates no better this Grok scenario that we are just animal, monkey-brained idiots. We have this, like, technology that could wipe us out. And instead, and I read an article last year where it was like most AI generation and improvements are basically caused by people just typing into like ChatGPT like tiger with boobs. And this is the dark side of that, being like naked kids.
Yeah.
Like, we're monkey-brained idiots. It's so depressing.
When people say it's incredibly useful to doctors, all I think is, fine, give it to doctors.
Yeah.
That's fine. And weirdly, the comedian Sam Campbell, because he's weirdly able to do some like weird shit. I genuinely believe you should have a license to use AI, and the only people who should be granted that license are medical professionals and one deeply strange and disturbed Australian.
Not being funny though, I think that's actually a really good idea about the license. Like, well, we've got some great ideas on this.
Yeah. You know, there's big concern about fake AI stuff when it comes to politics.
Yeah.
I think there should be a test that we give to people in the UK that is like three pictures, two are real, one is like the worst AI generated picture. Like, you know, we're talking like 19 fingers on a hand.
Or not the Queen high-fiving Elvis Presley.
Exactly, not a proper face. And anyone who believes that that is a real picture should lose the vote. That's my big,
got some
my
great
big policy
ideas
program.
In this.
Lose the vote if you think that's real.
On that slightly surprising note, Cody, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
on
you
Pod
for having
Take
me.
UK. Thanks for being here. You can follow Cody on Instagram. That's at Mr. Cody Dalla, and check out his podcast, The Truth, brackets, In My Opinion, close brackets.
Now, before we go, we wanted to draw your attention to a story that's at risk of being drowned out by global events. Just before Christmas, we shared an appeal for the Palestine Action hunger strikers on our socials. Some had been in prison since November 2024, and at the time, there were eight prisoners on hunger strike, with a doctor warning that they were on a, and I quote, trajectory that ended with death.
3 weeks later, and three of them are still on hunger strike, which for some has now lasted for over 60 days. One of them, Cameron Ahmed, has been hospitalised for the fifth time.
Currently, the strikers have trial dates set from April 2026 at the earliest, and for one protester, all the way to January 2027.
A close friend of one of the hunger strikers has been in contact with us. Neetha Jaffrey went to school with Amu Gibb, one of the activists accused of breaking into an airbase and spray painting two RAF planes. To explain the latest, here is an update that Neetha has sent in.
Hi Coco and Nish, I'm Neetha. I'm here to tell you about my best friend Amu. Along with seven other prisoners, Amu went on an open-ended hunger strike. All the hunger strikers are detained without trial. These are unusually long remand periods, legally disputed, cruel and unnecessary. By the time they stand before a jury, they will all already have been punished for more than a year. Five of the hunger strikers have paused after doctors warned them about long-term organ and brain damage. I still remember having to call Jeremy Corbyn to get Amu a wheelchair because they needed a wheelchair to walk around the prison. Hiba, Cameron and Louis are still on a hunger strike. When Hiba is on day 65, Cameron is on day 58 and Louis is on day 44. They want my friend to disappear. They want to punish and isolate them before their trials, to make an example of them, to call them terrorists for demanding to end war crimes.
I mean, thank you so much for sending that in. I had chills. I had goosebumps listening to that. They want to make them disappear. They want to make dissent disappear. What it means for all protesters, what it means for anyone moved by this, it's...
What it means for your right to a fair trial.
Yeah,
Just holding people on remand for this amount of time. This is unusual.
Yeah.
This is deeply unusual.
Mm. If any listeners feel as passionate and chilled as I felt listening to that, you can write to your MP. Please do. We've posted the link before. We will post it again in our show notes. If these lives are lost, it will be a moral stain upon this country, if this whole episode isn't already.
Yeah, our aim is just to keep this conversation happening in the media and keep asking the questions. Why are these prisoners being remanded for so long for direct action? And why are we repressing protest rights instead of calling for a full arms embargo on the Israeli government? That's the show. Thank you, as ever, so much for listening to Pod Save the UK. Don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the UK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter and Blue Sky.
Pod Save the UK is a reduced listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to lead producer May Robson and digital producer Jacob Liebenberg.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Our engineer is Jeep Vasani and our social media producer is Nada Smiljanic.
The executive producers are Kate Fitzsimons and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
The What A Day podcast you know and love is shaking things up. You already know that 5 days a week, I, Jane Costin, bring you the need-to-know news and expert analysis on the big stories shaping today and tomorrow. Stories like how social media warps our perception of the world and the strange reality of who is signing up to work for ICE. All in less time than it takes to roast a chicken. And now, What A Day episodes will be hitting your YouTube and podcast feeds in the afternoons. You'll get the breaking news even faster. Check out What A Day, now dropping in the PM on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.